Good evening and welcome to Dialect for Saturday the 17th of October. This week we take a close look at Castle Park. Campaigners have worked hard and thought they'd stop the council giving permission to build, or what is arguably Bristol's most important green space. But the Legal Services Department of Bristol City Council advise otherwise. The beleaguered Palestinian ghetto of Gaza. We'll hear from Ed Hill about the latest plans to link Bristol to the besieged country, which the Israeli government have cut off from the outside world. The campaign for nuclear disarmament, anti-nuclear Aldermaston March. We take a trip back into the 1960s to hear from one Bristol councillor who was there. And the evolution of the shopping mall. How did our open shopping streets become private covered space, policed by private security?
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Plans are afoot to link Bristol to Gaza, a beleaguered Arab area of occupied Palestine. The besieged Palestinian ghetto of Gaza is entirely surrounded by an Israeli-built barrier, reminiscent of the Berlin Wall or the Belfast Peace Wall. Ed Hill is from Bristol Gaza Link and joins us now. Hi Ed, could you tell us a bit about the Bristol Gaza Link?
Hi, thanks very much for having me on your show. Yes, it's very exciting, but first of all, can I pay tribute to the people of Bristol? They responded so magnificently last winter, turning out to demonstrate, to vigil, to show their utter horror at what was happening in the attacks on Gaza then. And it's so good that Bristol is now taking this project forward. So the Bristol-Gaza link, this way of joining up between our city and the people over in Gaza, is really happening and it's taking off right now.
And how do you think it's going to help the people over there having this almost like town twinning link?
Well, first of all, a bit of history. 2 weeks ago, we were given the council house. Full respect, thanks very much to the council. They gave us the council house to launch the event. We had 200 people. We had the largest range of stalls there for Palestine. And the whole evening was a magnificent success. And that launched the Bristol-Gaza link. And we've taken out membership, we're inviting membership to then go forward to a meeting next Monday when we will formally create the Bristol-Gaza Link Association. And that committee will then steer things. But what's really exciting, I think, is the direction that will take us in.
And is it the support that they feel they're getting from people of Bristol that's helping their cause over there?
You're absolutely right. The people of Palestine in the West Bank and in Gaza have really been ignored by most of the world, or rather the governments of the world, for more than 60 years now. So the more that we can hold out that hand of solidarity in the spirit of peace and justice for everybody, can I say, then that shows those ordinary people over there that they're not forgotten. And the main emphasis of our group is people-to-people, grassroots linking.
But you're also doing a practical support as well in the form of another convoy.
Well, we're talking about that in just a moment. Well, perhaps we'll start with that now. Yes, your listeners will remember that two drivers from Bristol drove vehicles to Gaza last winter, and they are part of the Bristol-Gaza link, and their experience now is leading us forward to form a new convoy this winter. And that will be part of a UK and international convoy which will go to Gaza, Viva Palestina. And our vehicles will be leaving Bristol just at the beginning of December, and the entire convoy is planned to reach the gates of Gaza, the Rafah crossing from Egypt, on the 27th of December. And I mean, doesn't a year go quickly? That is the anniversary of the bombs beginning to fall on Gaza a year ago.
So it'd be a very nice Christmas present for them.
It certainly will be. And our vehicles, we've already bought one huge articulated truck. brought in a few pictures. We're thinking about the graffiti and the pictures to go on the sides and such like. And that will be packed full of medical aid. I mean, there's some wonderful people out there in Bristol already with small warehouses packed full of medical equipment. We brought some of it to the council house. It was very touching to see wheelchairs, crutches, Zimmer frames and so on and so forth. And imagine the people who really need those. Do you know, they can't even get the artificial limbs for the people who have lost parts of their body in the attacks last winter. It's very important for your listeners to know that the siege continues on Gaza. The reconstruction hasn't been able to start. There are still people dying. There are still attacks going on. The fishing fleet can't go to sea. They are still besieged, even with the terrible loss and destruction that happened last winter.
So can you tell us a bit about the meeting that's coming up soon at the Pyrion Centre?
Yes, it's next Monday, and it will start at 7 o'clock at the Pyrion Centre, which is in Portland Square, St Paul's. Everyone is welcome. People who want to come along and just find out a bit more about the practicalities of our plans of how we're linking up with Gaza, and people who perhaps want to put in some work and be elected onto the committee to help steer things. I have to say, of all the campaigns and groups I've been involved in, this one is so dynamic. There's such a spirit that takes everybody together forward to get so much done. So that's next Monday. And also, I'd like to mention our website. I mean, people go on to www.bristolgazalink.org. That is our main front page. And then there's a link that can take you through to an innovative social networking site. Now, I personally, I've stayed away from Facebook and MySpace, but I'm in there now and I'm discovering the incredible power of social networking websites. We might be the first people in the country to be doing this. And the membership creeps up every day. We've got members in the West Bank, we've got members in Gaza, as well as a whole lot of people here in Bristol. And this is the way in which people can begin to join up, first of all by email. And then our projects will roll out to joining up between schools, educational establishments, universities, faith groups, trade unions, community groups. The list goes on. Anything can link up with anything, people to people, grassroots level, between Bristol and Gaza.
So very widespread and open to everybody. So good luck with the meeting. And I hope that listeners will come along and join the cause and support the Palestinians.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
A few hundred had been expected at the start, but already the column is 4,500 strong. They have come in their thousands to show their opposition to policies based upon the threat of mass annihilation. It is 53 miles to London. Many marchers carry the symbol of the campaign for nuclear disarmament, the semaphore signal ND. They are pledged to the common cause of mankind. Each, by marching, denies the growing fear that the people of the world are mere puppets, incapable of influencing events by their personal actions. They know that a nuclear war will mean suicide for Britain, that nuclear weapons are no defense, that there can be no victors, only vanquished. They march for Britain to give a lead to the nations of the world. They ask for an act of greatness.
In 1959, thousands of people marched to Aldermaston, worried about the nuclear impact on future generations. Jenny Smith, who's here in the studio with us, was one of those people who marched, and she's here to tell us about her experiences. Hello, Jenny.
Hello.
Long time ago, what happened?
Well, it all started for me being born, being brought up in a village, Satcham, near Greenham Common, which was near Aldermaston, and which also quite near Harwell. So I was sort of sandwiched growing up in a community that were beginning to get concerned about what was happening around them. I also went to work for a firm called Isotope Developments, and that was the peaceful uses of nuclear energy. It was a steel company of Wales, checking how hot the vats were. It was what was happening here in the BRI, where they started to use nuclear processes to check. And then people who I worked with, one or two of them, developed leukemia. So it was obvious that perhaps the materials that we were developing and using weren't good.
What was going on at Hartwell and Aldermaston at
Hartwell
the time?
Hartwell was the development of nuclear energy and all sorts of innovations. But Aldermaston was more about the weapons side, although my brothers tried to convince me they were also there to clear up after the event of an atomic bomb.
So how did local people find out what was going on? Because it must have been very secret.
It was very top secret. But I think things really started to come ahead after there were major accidents at Greenham Common. In August 1957, there was a fire at Greenham Common. And then later on, this involved a loading of a nuclear bomb that went wrong on Greenham Common. There was a second serious fire in 1958, and part of the explosion that took place either hit or nearly hit one of the bunkers, and we could never really get to the bottom of it, neither could the press. So I was sitting in Cropper's office at the time, which was a big open plan office. There was a major explosion. We were less than a mile away from Greenham. A voice said, "We'll know if we're dead in 3 minutes." And we all just sat there because everybody realised there was just nowhere in the event of it being major that we could run to.
So you're actually caught up in the nuclear dangers that were coming out of these plants.
Well, that's right. And subsequently they found that a very private girls' school was downwind for the last event, and a lot of the staff and the girls got leukemia.
Do you think nuclear accidents still happen in secret today?
I'm sure they do. I'm sure they do in nuclear power stations. Chernobyl wasn't the only one. We hear about Russia. We don't hear so much about what happens at Hinkley. We don't hear about what happens up in Northumbria. There are nuclear power stations which I think is extremely dangerous as well.
But a lot of young people were caught up in this movement, weren't they? The CND movement. Why did it start to influence young people, the movement? Why did they feel so strongly about it?
I think it was fear. Fear about we were trying to contain something that was extremely dangerous. Fear about the future generations and what we were giving to them with the contamination of land. And also partly because younger people were beginning to demand a better world and we were looking ahead. Whereas before, many of us were living in structures where we weren't, how do I say it? We were demanding different music. We were demanding different clothes. We were demanding all sorts of different things from society than our parents had.
It was the cultural revolution.
It was a cultural revolution going on. I was a beatnik. That was about the same time as the, what are they called? It was the Teddy Boys. And you hear a lot about Teddy Boys, but you don't actually hear about the alternatives that were beginning to form at that time.
Well, don't you think it was also to do with education, that a lot of people were going to university and becoming more educated, and the universities themselves were becoming more active in the political scene at the time?
Yes, I think politics was changing rapidly too. Ordinary people were realising that they could actually, by voting, change who was there and what was happening and put things on the agenda of the political world, which we need today desperately. In 1958, went picketing in the houses at Aldermaston, on the main gate, and I always remember there was a caravan in a field, and that was the first time I met Pat Arrowsmith, and that was the very first Quaker meeting I went to.
What was the reaction from the police to all the young people being involved? Were they quite patient and quite...
They were, first of all, but then Aldermaston wasn't surrounded by the fencing is today and all the security. It was just a village, really, with a nuclear factory and system in it. And they didn't really realise that people could feel so much as we felt about it.
Do you think the police were on your side at that point, when it first started?
Oh, I found the odd police over the years when I was Greenland Common fencing that were on our side. It was obvious, and some weren't. So you have a mixture even among the establishment themselves.
Did you know many people arrested or charged?
I didn't know them. My brother, I can remember, we discussed whether he was going to be one of those arrested, and you actually chose whether you were going to take direct action or not direct action, which is what happens today in demonstrations. It was like we were setting patterns for what was going to come later on. I didn't go on the march, not the first one, because I was on my honeymoon. But
Fair
the
enough.
Whole of my family went. So I came back to all the stories and everything.
So do you think that this huge demonstration was the start? I mean, we're still involved with the nuclear issue. Do you think we're still under the threat of the nuclear topic?
Oh, I've no doubt that it's still there. I mean, I've joined... I came back to the UK, and in 1976, I went on a march with only 300 people. So by that time, it was beginning to peter out. The big surge had gone through, and then it was, oh, well, that's just C&D. And then, subsequently, it started to grow again, because there were new issues. There were nuclear warheads being pulled around the country.
Where was that?
Coming out of Greenham, and they were coming out of many of the air bases
was
and put
Americans?
On the road. That was the Americans. And my daughter at that time, she was a volunteer and worked for C&D in London, and she was one of those that was bugged, and she did a lot of their graphics for them.
But we've had this threat recently, haven't we?
It's coming back again.
With the ones that the Americans proposed to put into Europe, so it hasn't gone away.
Well, that's right. Northern Europe, on the borders of Russia, they were looking for having some of the installations there. It doesn't go away. It's a matter of younger generations realising, and it has to be a realisation that says to them, we've got to do something about this. And we're back to, well, the sort of world we want, the sort of world our children should have, and whether we are willing to use a material that not only contaminates, but can destroy, in some cases, hundreds and hundreds of miles. Because it's not just the bomb that would go off, it would be the fallout, the contamination. And that's cancers, that's leukemias, that's deformities. We've seen it with Chernobyl. Those poor kids that come and have holidays in Bristol. And you think... Surely we've got enough sense as a society. I'm delighted that the Labour Party is starting to cut back on Trident. It's almost like, well, I've been there ahead of you, but I don't mind for you pinching all my ideas and the ideas of the past just to achieve peace.
Why do you think that young people now aren't demonstrating like people were in the 1950s? Why aren't they up in arms about...
Well, I think they have. They've been signifying that they were against Iraq. They're signifying that they're worried about wars as a whole. And I think people are more aware now, because we have a larger coverage of the media, of what's happening right across the world and what could happen. So I think that people are identifying that we've got to change the society we live in and the society other people live in.
But is the CND still strong, or has it faded away?
No, CND's still there, and we still take part. We took part in the Gentleman Performers demonstration. We were there, and I think that it comes and it goes, and what we need is the younger people to realise this hasn't gone away. It was an issue for your mums and your dads, and it's an issue that will go on until we actually solve it. One of the banners that I saw up in London, which I thought hit the nail on the head, it was "Historians demand ongoing work, and unless we get rid of these dangerous weapons and this material which can contaminate, then we won't have a future history."
To conclude, Jenny, do you think we'll ever live in a nuclear-free world?
I think it's got to be. I think we're living in dangerous times, and I have been almost since I came into this world, and we've got to demand that we get rid of this, these nuclear weapons, this using contaminated material in our society, because if we don't, then it could be complete annihilation for the whole world, not just a bit of it.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. UK.
We had Jenny Smith in the studio this evening talking about CND and the march on Aldermaston. There have been 20 accidents involving nuclear weapons in the UK, and Claire Thomas, a new volunteer, is going to read from a book, Secrets and Lies, by David Southwell.
On July the 27th, 1956, the county of Suffolk in England almost became a nuclear wasteland. An American B-47 bomber coming into land at RAF Lakenheath crashed and careered into a nuclear weapons storage bunker. The plane exploded and showered the three Mark 6 US bombs in the bunker with burning jet fuel. Firefighting teams managed to douse the blaze before the conventional explosive in the bombs could trigger a nuclear detonation. The commanding officer of the US 7th Air Division sent a memo to General Curtis LeMay, commander of US Strategic Air Command, stating, "Preliminary exam by bomb disposal says a miracle that one Mark 6 with exposed detonators didn't go. Setting a policy of secrecy and deceit that continues until this day, the American government and the British Ministry of Defence, MOD, decided to deny that an accident had happened. Even in 1985, the MOD still claimed that the B-47 had hit a stationary plane and no fire had occurred. Declassified documents from the 1960s show that in the event of a major accident involving American nukes, the British government would have stopped the US from ordering evacuations and releasing details in an attempt to avoid panic. Until 2003, the MOD continued to refuse to admit that any accident involving British nuclear weapons had occurred at all. After a sustained campaign by the Guardian newspaper, they admitted to 7 incidents. Among these was the dropping of a torpedo on top of a store of nuclear warheads on the submarine HMS Tiger while it was anchored off Malta in 1974. They also acknowledged 3 road accidents that had involved convoys carrying British nukes. However, they refused to provide details of any other mishaps involving nuclear weapons because they claimed they did not involve any threat to public safety. Given that an investigation by the MOD's chief scientific advisor, Ronald Oxberg, hints at more than 20 mishaps, and that the MOD had decided not to tell the public of any accidental nuclear detonation in the UK, not many people will find that reassuring.
That was Claire Thomas reading from Secrets and Lies by David Southwell.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
It's arguably Bristol's most important park. Historically, it was Bristol Castle until destroyed on Cromwell's orders at the end of the English Civil War to stop Bristolians rebelling against his rule. It's now used every day by workers to relax in their lunchtime, commuters on their way to work and shoppers just to take a break. But Bristol City Council is planning with developers to build on part of it, much to the consternation of green space campaigners. One councillor who's been on the inside of the planning wrangles is Labour councillor for Brislington East, Simon Crewe. Simon, welcome to Dialect.
Hi, thank you.
What committee are you on that's been discussing this?
I'm on the Public Rights of Way and Greens Committee, which on August the 3rd discussed the application to make Castle Park a town green, which would have protected it.
And what's the committee's makeup?
The committee is made up on the basis of the groups on the council. So there is 5 Liberal Democrats, 2 Labour and 2 Conservatives.
Where are the developers and the council wanting to build on the park?
Well, there's no planning application as such yet, but certainly it would be in the St Mary LaPorte side of the park. And the application to the committee I'm on would have protected it by declaring Castle Park a town green.
What about the Bank of England and Norwich Union building? Why have these buildings been derelict for so long?
Well, the report has said that they are old-fashioned and not of modern usage. But presumably whatever landowners there are waiting for any development to sell them off.
Is that the 1960s-style ones near Bristol Bridge?
Yes, yeah.
Because some of those have got quite nice stone features. Mm. Simon, until World War II, weren't there shops along the edge of the park from Bristol Bridge up to the Bank of England?
Yes, they were. Indeed, the whole area really was Bristol's main shopping centre. But as far as the application for a town green is concerned, the legal definition is that for a 20-year use of the area, it's a significant number of inhabitants of any locality have indulged as of right in lawful sports and pastimes on the land for a period of at least 20 years. And I was the only one on the committee to say that, that it fitted that criteria.
So what have campaigners identified as the best way to stop Castle Park from being built on?
Well, I think it's probably unlikely that there will be an appeal to the Town Green application, which is a shame because the way it was dealt with, I think, was disgrace. But I think we're waiting really for a planning application to come in and we will oppose that.
So is this some sort of legal squabble going on between the council and the campaigners?
Not at the moment. I'd say that the council, when they had the application for the town green, they appointed a eminent QC to run a non-statutory public inquiry, and his findings at the end, it all came down. I mean, because the Public Rights of Way and Greens Committee is a quasi-judicial committee, and you can only make the decisions based on law. It came down to what was done by the council in 1978, saying if the land had been appropriated as a park by the council, then the town green application would fail because the council was a landowner and would have given permission to use it. Therefore, people would have been using it by right and not as of right. People who were looking into another town green application found council documents from 1978 which specifically said that the land had been transferred and not appropriated. Therefore, my view was you got it in black and white, the council documents which prove the land was transferred, not appropriated, therefore the town green application should go ahead.
So can we trust the impartiality of the council's legal services department, do you think?
well, I wouldn't... Uh, what the recommendation was that sometimes council officers do not understand the proper wording of these things. So they're saying that the whoever wrote this down, and it was someone in the city treasury, didn't know the proper legal terms. I'd say I've got more faith in the abilities of council officers to know what they're doing.
If people are using Castle Park for recreation, are the council acting in the interests of the people of Bristol or the developers on this issue?
Well, I think we will have to see into what happens, because despite the fact the all the Liberal Democrats on the committee voted the application down, they put forward an amendment, which is odd, really, because they use the excuse that they must follow the legal advice to vote it down. And then their amendment, the legal officer said there was nothing legally for them to recommend to the Cabinet, because it's not within the remit of the committee. But they still voted through that the committee requests the Council Cabinet to consider bringing forward proposals to make Castle Park voluntarily a town green, and that any development for the St Mary the Port site seeks to reduce the footprint, so protecting open space in Castle Park. So really, it's up to the Cabinet to answer what the committee have asked.
So who's actually running this department? Because it doesn't say anything on the council website.
No, I should imagine there is a high-level negotiations going on, and the first we'll know about it is when the application comes out, but certainly the ball is within the Cabinet at the moment.
So there's a lot of people out there who feel very strongly about Castle Park. How can they get involved in the campaign?
Well, absolutely. There is a Castle Park users group, which I know have been very active on this issue. I only came into this as a member of the Public Rights and Way and Greens Committee, so I haven't been involved with the actual protesters. I just sat there as an impartial member of the committee and totally agreed with their evidence.
So there's nothing on the website? There's no website where people can voice their discontent about what's going to happen or what may happen?
Well, yes, certainly people can contact the parks groups, but at the moment I'm waiting to see if any planning application comes forward, and I think this evidence will be a good evidence against any planning application and to save Castle Park.
So hopefully you'll keep us up to date on what happens in the future.
Yes, I will, yeah.
So, Simon Crewe, Labour councillor for Brislington East, thank you very much for joining us this evening.
Thank you. Thanks.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Last week, the Pirion Centre in Portland Square hosted a debate organised by the Architectural Centre in Bristol. One of the speakers was Louis Rice, RIBA, Senior Research Fellow in Urban Design at the University of Western England.
Louis Rice.
You gave a very interesting talk tonight on the history of shopping. Could you just tell us a bit about that?
I trace back the history of shopping over the last 200 years, and the modern shopping mall was its early ancestor was basically the arcade, the shopping arcade, which happened about 200 years ago. And it was a fruition of the Industrial Revolution, where there was growth of the kind of moneyed upper middle classes at the same time as a boom in mass production of goods. And the first kind of urban form of the Industrial Revolution was the shopping arcade. And the first one was in Paris 200 years ago. It was quickly copied as an urban model in London, in Milan, in Berlin, and also over in America and Australia. And this kind of architectural typology has been copied again of this central daylit boulevard with shops on either side. Has really stayed intact for over 200 years. The main change, I guess, is over that time, is with the, apart from the invention of the car, which goes very unnoticed, is the invention of air conditioning. And air conditioning allowed the development of huge shops before, you know, that allowed artificial light and the heat of all the people in there. And they have now really deep planned buildings that couldn't have been technically possible beforehand, and enabling bigger and bigger shops. Factors that people realised was that as shops got bigger, people would spend more time in it, which meant they spent more money and there was more sales and became more profitable. And also, as kind of shops got bigger and bigger, there was less connection with the outside. And eventually, in about the 30s, they realised that the shop window was not just unnecessary. When you got rid of shop windows, that sales increased. So there was a kind of boom between the 30s and 50s to get bigger and bigger shops with less and less connection to the outside, more air conditioning. And then the kind of psychologists got involved and they realised that there's a perfect temperature that encourages people to shop, which is kind of a permanent spring. And so shopping malls have all, you know, there's no kind of real idea about day or night. It's artificially lit and artificially controlled. The temperature is always the same. It never changes in summer or winter to create a completely artificial environment.
So it's a very unreal...
It's a totally unreal environment. They realise that along with artificial temperature, artificial day and night, that breaking the connection to the outside was really important in encouraging people to spend longer there. And the longer people spend, the more money they spend as well, so there's more revenue. And so really, from the 50s onwards, shopping malls became not just bigger and bigger, they also embodied kind of fantasy lands, really, and dreamscapes. A bit like, most famously, it's kind of Disney World, where they become...
Las Vegas,
very famous, where everything becomes more and more artificial and everything is trying to sell an idea of a fantasy, really. So the shopping becomes more than... is no longer just going and buying your sausages or eggs. It becomes part of a lifestyle, part of a dream and part of an escape from the rest of the city. So the shopping mall becomes a kind of dream or fantasy.
You showed a photograph of a shopping mall in America. What date was that?
The first one was in 1956 in Southdale, and that was the very first what we would describe as a shopping mall, where they put all these big box shops together with a kind of central walkway through. It was all air conditioned, and that was the first time an out-of-town shopping mall was generated. Very shortly afterward, that was kind of copied across America, well, mainly across America to start with, and then that has spread across Europe, Australia, and really everywhere around the world now. Even in China, which has really only embraced capitalism in the last 10 years, there's been a huge boom of shopping malls. And the same in India, Russia, China, virtually all around the world, it's become a model that's been copied again and again.
What about ghost malls?
Yeah, the shopping malls only have a lifespan of I don't know, 20, 30, 40 years. It depends, really. And a new phenomenon is what's called ghost malls or dead malls. And these are the shopping malls that become defunct when a newer, bigger, shinier one is built nearby, or is just becomes outdated and unpopular and is left derelict, basically. Estimates by Walmart, is one of the biggest supermarkets in the USA, predict that 20% of all malls will be ghost malls. And the latest predictions are, because of the world recession, that number will be greater than 20%. Again, even in China, which has only 10 years worth of kind of shopping malls, really, there's already ghost malls. So the kind of lifespan of these buildings is sometimes very, very short.
So what do they do with these ghost malls?
Sometimes they're just left, just left derelict.
Like blocked
for years.
On a...
Yeah, but they're normally in the middle of nowhere, so they're just closed off. You can't, the junction from the motorway is closed off, so they're kind of left to kind of rot. Often they are redeveloped into another function or a different use. Sometimes they'll be, after a certain amount of time, redeveloped into a new, refitted out into a new shopping mall. But a lot of them are just left, particularly in America, where land is much cheaper. They just leave it alone. There's a whole kind of area called in the Rust Belt where whole communities are just left vacant. So the houses are left empty, the shopping malls are left empty, and they're literally just left with just like a tumbleweed going past them.
So is this your specialist subject, shopping?
No, I run the urban design program programme at the university, trained as an architect, so I'm more interested in kind of urban design and kind of cultural theory, but shopping is obviously a kind of fundamental part of any city.
How do you see the future of Bristol in terms of shopping?
It's very hard to predict. In the short term, the economic crisis is obviously impacting quite heavily on the shops. However, I think in the longer term, there appears to be capacity for more and more shopping within the city. There's been kind of talk about internet sales killing off the local shops or the city centre mall, but there appears to be enough capacity for both of it. So I think the kind of model, there seems to be two really big trends. One is the big shopping mall like Cabot Circus, and the other one is the resurgence of the local shop. For decades, there's been a kind of dropping off of or dying out of the local butchers, the local bakers, and recently we've seen the death of local pubs as well. So that is a kind of a long-term trend. There's also been a resurgence of local markets and fresh food and farmers' markets, which is really shopping at the kind of most basic, which is, you know, that which we've been doing for thousands of years, which is really kind of a table and some goods on it. That's really boomed in the last few years. And so retail's really kind of polarising into two. One is a huge shopping mall, and one is this kind of grassroots farmers' markets and car boots and bric-a-brac. And so there's those two kind of totally separate lives going on at the moment.
Do you think Cabot Circus is more of a day-out entertainment for the family?
Cabot Circus is definitely more of a day out. There's very few people can walk there from the local kind of community or the local distance. So it's much more of a, you have to do quite a journey to get there. So it's always going to be for more of a day out. Whereas the markets can cater for, there's some very up markets. So there's lots of organic, very expensive markets that sell quite exclusive and niche stuff. But there's also kind of much cheaper fruit and veg markets. And local community markets are where the goods are much cheaper. But the people make much smaller journeys to that. So they always tend to be much more local to that kind of, more people would walk to it, for example, and much more kind of local community needs, basically.
Do you think the local markets have been inspired by people going to France and seeing French markets and the arrival of the French markets over here?
Yes, the kind of organic and local markets is really has never kind of died off in Europe, in kind of mainland Europe. It used to happen much more in England, but kind of from the 60s onwards, there's been a lack of demand, but also kind of local planning authorities have tried to kind of clear those areas and remove the kind of facility to do that in England, where in Italy and France and Spain particularly, it never died off as a culture, even within, in rural ones, but even in kind of metropolitan cities, there's always been daily markets and weekly markets. And as people have gone over to France and Italy and Spain, they're really bringing that kind of culture back in.
That was Louis Rice talking about the debate at the Pyrion Centre, Portland Square, organised by the Architectural Centre of Bristol.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Out this week, we're now going to play The Truth Will Set You Free by Scootle Royal.
Turn off the TV, what you think of this news is just a movie. There's war going on and poverty, while they're feeding you crap about celebrities. They simplify things to make you dumb. They'll even tell you Saturn's closer to the sun. The last thing that they want is for the slave to think. That's why they're putting poison in your food and drink. They're sentenced to silence, they're never appraised. Only the good guys are ever blown away. Give up all your rights and you'll be saved from the big private time lord in a cave. Islamic nuts don't snort cocaine. The wake of flight school dropouts have such good aim. Cheney must have been flying those planes. So P-TECH and MITRE and the FAA. The truth will set you free from global tyranny. Wake up, American slobs. 9/11 wasn't in inside ya. 9/11 wasn't inside ya. Two towers fall symmetrically. Injecting steel beams more than 500 feet. Tower 7 falls at free fall speed. Reported in advance by the BBC. The perfect excuse to go to war. To gain power and control and kill millions more. Many other buildings have suffered worse, but none have ever turned into a cloud of dust. Explosions were heard throughout the day. Molten metal was seen flowing away. The power still burning after months of rain. And what's the deal with this explosive paint? Trains explode in major cities, destroyed by bombs made by the military. The whole suggests they were attached underneath. God save our city, it's not you. The truth will set you free from global tyranny. Wake up, American slums. 9/11 was an inside job. The truth will set you free from global tyranny. Wake up, American slums. 9/11 was an inside job. 9/11 was an inside job. Left or right, it's all just a game. Two wings of the same bird of prey. Money is debt, I know it sounds insane. And the jams you give your kids just damage their brains. The Nazis never died, they simply moved. And now they're at it again, it's easy to prove. The elite don't hide the fact that they're a bunch of crooks. Rockefeller brags about it in his books. They have a plan, and it must fail. Or they'll be taxing us every time we exhale. And there'll be cameras in homes for them to spy on the slaves. Orwell's rolling in his grave. They're scaring us all into demanding this too. With terrorism, climate change and overhyped flu. The truth must come out, it's all up to you. Before we're forced onto internet too. The truth will set you free from global tyranny. Wake up, American slobs. 9/11 was an inside job. The truth will set you free from global tyranny. Wake up, American slobs. 9/11 was an inside job. The truth will set you free. 9/11 was an inside job. The truth will set you free. 9/11 was an inside job. The truth will set you free from global tyranny. Wake up, American slums. 9/11 was an inside job. 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 9/11 was an inside job.
That was The Truth Will Set You Free by Scootal Royale, which came out this week.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Now for another instalment of The Innkeeper's Diary, read by Malcolm Greaves, a story set in Oxfordshire between 1920 and 1930. In 1922, out of the need to earn a living, Mr. John Fothergill moved with his family to Thame in Oxfordshire to run the Spread Eagle Inn. The people and customs he came across was not quite what he was expecting or used to. He wrote about his experiences in a diary.
An Innkeeper's Diary by John Fothergill. The Physiology of Disappointment. Sunday, a lovely day in the midst of nationally destructive weather, and instead of 60 people, 6 came to lunch. As much of a surprise as when on a bad day last March, 85 came. This sort of washout makes one feel flat. It's not the not having made any money, nor even the loss of it, because one is careless of the joints once they are cooked, nor the feeling that one is not perhaps serving a useful purpose, but having worked oneself up for an effort and then not making it is just as if one had trained, changed, rubbed down and got to the starting post for a race to be told that the race was off. All the steam manufactured for use is pent up. It can't escape through the natural channel, but goes into the blood and bones, and poisons. A. Kingham, faithful friend to us, was here for the weekend. He was one of our first lodgers when Gerald Gould and Langdon Davis, generally the only people in the house. 10 years ago, when Kingham was political, he embarrassed me, a nervous wreck, in the RAC smoking room, by wanting to stand up on a chair and inveigh against the harmless members and non-members as capitalists. Fat white lady. A man brought in a sumptuous Rolls-Royce, a very fat, bejewelled woman in white flannel, who sat at the table with billows of white fat in front of her. She appealed to me. I liked her, and we joked. Apropos of nothing, she suddenly asked in a loud voice before the others in the room, "And what do you think of me?" It was damn difficult to reply, so I said, "Oh, you have some style. But is it the right style?" I felt now that the room expected me to give her the proper reply. So looking at her streaming ropes of pearls, I said, "Well, you look like the Maharaja of Baroda out for the afternoon." And thank God, she was as amused as my remark was kindly intended. Will Rothenstein once asked me what my father did, and I told him that he spent most of his time thinking out the proper thing to do and say. Surely enough work for two men. Indeed, many times since I took this in, I have felt ashamed for working for a living. Such reactionary feeling was confirmed by a sentence I read recently in one of the Upanishads. And work, that vile thing. For when work is imposed upon you, you get boggled or disgruntled or hardened and behave ill to others, and especially yourself. G.K. Chesterton and three young folks lunched. I said to him, "You were the first to expose cheese in biscuits as a corruption of the cheese. Now I have made these biscuits with which to confute you." He replied, "I'm almost inclined to recant, and on the whole, I would say now that to eat cheese with these biscuits is a corruption of the biscuits." Talking about sauces, I told him how well he himself could write about sauces in relation to the thing eaten with them. For instance, the French laugh at our only sauce, bread sauce. But when well made, it is nothing more delicious, and no sauce better adapted to its vehicle. But why do we spoil lamb with mint sauce and give its capers to mutton? This shook the Chateau Chesterton to my 18th century chair rungs. Thomas Burke and Inns. Thomas Burke and his bright wife, Green Fields of England, came for the night. 2 years ago we found it difficult to associate this quaint, correct, grateful, wise little man with Limehouse Nights. In his book of the inn, He says we are the only inn in England that he knows where the meal is not an hotel meal. And why aren't there other places like ours? The requirements for keeping a good inn are 1. 14 to 16 hours a day, and few even half days off. 2. Some capital, with which to have good food ready and to waste. 3. A mind for the tiniest details. 4. An all-round outlook. 5. An ability to formulate a policy and courage to carry it out. 6. To have had first a good time in life oneself. And 7. A natural, not enforced, love of the job. Wherever an inn fails in England or elsewhere, it will be, I think, for the lack of one or more of these requirements. This place, at least, has required them all. Evan Morgan comes with his usual big party to dinner. He pays for the meal and does all the talking. That's not fair. Since becoming politician, he seems to have lost the romantic and ascetic that he used to have. He leaves his priceless fur coat in our office and brings all his friends to pile theirs. It's his welcome prerogative, and provocative as Kate calls it, for he used to come here in our simple days as well as his. But tonight, when one of them came in to get his cigarettes, I couldn't help asking if he minded my eating my supper in his cloakroom. The difference between the place now and what it was lies in this. When we came here, like our predecessors, we had to stand and wait for our custom, like every other country or seasonal inn. We depended upon the weekly visitations of the farmers, the Freemasons, the grammar school biennial dinner, race meetings, the local bar, rent audits, commercials, people held up by fog. I can't describe what an anxiety this dependence was, because if these failed through weather or foot and mouth disease or other cause, there was nothing. It was at best a limited, unexpandable trade, a blind alley job, and worse, we had to put up with all sorts of treatment from our paymasters. In our first days, a party of artistes had been lodged here by a local philanthropist for his annual concert. There was no one else at dinner, of course, and halfway through I came in and saw one of them standing on an 18th century chair making foolish. Rather timidly, I asked him to get down and not endanger the chair when one of the others called out, "Nah, me man, none of that." And one baking hot day, the son of a local county came in and asked for a dozen siphons. As there was no man in the yard, I had to carry this impossible load all the way down myself. When I came out of the archway, I saw in front of me, perched high in a Ford car, the hard, permigenious face of the lady herself. Though feeling like to drop, I forced up a little wan smile as I struggled near and looked up at her. "Put them in the back," she ordered in a sepulchral voice, and I was glad to drop the smile and the siphons. And now, what a relief to make our own trade.
Thank you, Malcolm. You can hear another instalment next week.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Just a reminder that Tinsfield, the National Trust property, just outside Bristol, will be closing its doors at the end of October. So it's your last chance to see the house, which is being renovated. Fabulous grounds, lots to see and do. So check it out on their website. Well, that's all for this week's show. Dialect is a community podcast which is broadcast on Bristol Community FM at 93.2 across the city at 9 p.m. every Saturday. You can find us on the web at dialectradio.co.uk, at bristol.indymedia.org.uk, and listen live on the web at bcfm.org.uk. Dialect is Bristol Radio Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to either do reporting, engineering, or just making tea, do please get in touch via Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733. Or you can find them on the web at volunteer.org.uk. Thanks for our studio guests, Ed Hill, Jenny Smith and Simon Crew. Reporters this week were Anthea Page. Our studio engineer was Johnny Royden. The producer was Tony Goslin. It's all from me, Anthea Page. Until next week, goodbye.